Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello. This is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by Sonali Chakravarti, and she is author of Radical Enfranchisement in the Jury Room and Public Life. This was published in 2019 by the University of Chicago Press. This is a really interesting consideration of the role of juries and how they operate, and also how we should think about what goes on in the jury room itself. But I'm going to let Sonali tell us a little bit about that and also how she came to this project. Hi, Sonali. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, Lily. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here and to talk with you about this book. So first, maybe I'll talk a little about how I came to this project. My doctoral dissertation and my first book was about the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And the name of that book was Sing the Rage, Listening to Anger After Mass Violence. And there I looked at how do we listen to expressions of anger and rage when citizens talk about what happened to them during mass violence. And I thought that that period of upheaval and the possibilities of rebuilding trust after mass violence made it a really distinctive period for incorporating citizens into political institutions and into political life in a new way. But one of the things I said in that book is that when we listen to people who have often been excluded from political life and listen to their anger, that should just be the beginning of a process of citizenship, and that they should not only be valued for their testimonies of suffering, but for their ability to be political decision makers, and they should be given, you know, the dignity, authority, and respect of full citizens. And so that got me thinking, like, where are the institutions in the U.S. where we allow ordinary citizens, not experts, not elected officials, to have decision-making power? And that's how I came to the jury. And I really see it as a distinctive in our legal and political landscape, one of the few examples of direct democracy in action. And where the fact that you don't know a lot about the law when you're going in is an asset and is something that that our legal system values, because the jury is the sort of final check on the state when it comes to a punishment, in that no one should be punished by the state, should have their liberties taken away, unless a jury of their peers of 12 ordinary people have decided that that is the appropriate way to proceed. And we don't want to make that a formulaic decision. We don't want machines to do it. We want ordinary people to make that decision.
And so you do a number of interesting and useful things in this book for those of us who are not experts on juries, and I am not. And I have a feeling many listeners may not be experts on juries. I mean, we understand them because we see sort of presentations of this all over in popular culture. And you start the book with, you know, reference to 12 Angry Men, a classic sort of story about a jury room. And again, you know, this is on television every night in terms of our understanding, and many people have served on juries as well. But you're sort of talking about the dynamic that goes on and should perhaps be how we think about the jury itself. Can you talk a little bit about, because you trace this in the book, sort of where juries came from?
Sure. The Magna Carta is what was considered one of the first recorded documents that considers a jury. And in the case of the Magna Carta, the idea was that if the king were to truly have limited power, right, to add a check on the king, if a baron were on trial, the baron should be tried by a jury of his peers, other elites, but people who were not appointed by the king. So there was a sense that for power to be legitimately held, for power to be stable within an institution, there has to be a check on absolutism, and the jury is one such check. And through the development of the common law system, the jury played an important role. And I write in the book about the idea of mixed juries, which is a type of jury researched in a book by Marion Constable, who's at Berkeley, about how in the Middle Ages, if a foreigner were on trial in England, or a merchant, or someone of a religious minority, they would for the trial to go forward, they have half the jurors should be from the same group as the defendant. Because the idea was that if we really want to understand the logic of this violation and also have a jury that is sympathetic to the defendant, which is also a key part of why we have a jury, then it makes sense to make sure the jurors understand the life world of the defendant. And this is, you know, this is a far cry from where we are now, where, you know, if you know anything, you know, if you know the defendant personally, you are excused from the jury. Oftentimes, jurors are selected from a locality that is quite far, far removed, either socioeconomically or, you know, even geographically from where the crime took place. But the idea of the jury was important to the common law process and was very important to the founders. It was important because during the colonial period, the juries were where the British power was checked. And juries all, you provided this way of kind of trying out local rule, right? Letting those who lived in the colonies make decisions about punishment that happened where they lived. And then after independence, juries were important in the balance between local and federal power. The idea is that the jury is the place where we decide whether the law that's on the books really should be enforced in this way at this particular time. The law we want it to be fair, but we also know that, you know, each person who is accused of violating the law should be given individual consideration, and we should think about whether it makes sense to apply the law in this way at this time. And so the founders really fought for juries to be included in the Constitution. And in those debates, the term enfranchisement was not just about the ability to vote, but was about the ability to serve on a jury. And this, because it was seen that if that right is protected, that's one of the most important checks on either the overreach of the power of the state or the sort of tyranny of the majority, the violence that some citizens might do to other citizens. And we need a check on that as well.
And that was one of the points that you make early on in the book that I found really fascinating to consider, that the idea of enfranchisement, again, most of the time we think about that as the right to vote. But as you note, the founders in particular thought of this, and it's kind of embedded in their notion of this as the role of serving on a jury and of voting, and that this is a sort of the role of citizenship. Can you talk a little bit about how these two parts together are also part of the sort of spine of your thesis in terms of the idea of radical enfranchisement?
Sure. I think you're right to talk about these two parts together. The jury is something that we need to people might serve on, you know, one, two, or three times in their life, you know, and whereas voting is something that we are, you know, pay special attention to at certain times, but is, you know, a regular part of our life, and in an important way we hold representatives to account. But what I think is so powerful about the jury is that you're not using representatives. Like, people actually have final decision making power. They can stop someone from going to prison. They can punish people who they think are deserving of it, and being given that type of power is an ennobling experience. And one interesting thing that social psychological studies have shown is that people who serve on juries come out with a greater appreciation of the criminal justice system and sort of feeling pretty good about themselves and about their fellow jurors. Oftentimes, they say it was incredibly difficult work, like that there's, you know, like emotions run high, people really question, their assumptions, and they get frustrated with their other jurors. But by and large, people think that the system works. And my argument for radical enfranchisement is trying to get us to kind of lean into the higher demands of the juror as a way to think about sort of the higher demands of citizenship that we might bring to other parts of our lives. And one of the things I discuss in the book is that we need to be educated more in how to become jurors. Like you mentioned, that we can, like on TV every night, you can see something about juries. And I also talk about like the rise of true crime podcasts, which has kind of made jurors out of us all. I think that first podcast Serial that was so popular was really put listeners in the jury seat to be like, who's lying here? What, and also, what do you do when it seems like everybody's lying? How do you try to get to the heart of a story? And Serial did a good job also of showing that you might think someone is guilty, but deciding whether the state met the burden of proof to prove beyond a reasonable doubt is a different type of standard. You have to be able to decide, are you judging just according to your gut reaction to something, or are you able to apply the standard of reasonable doubt? But I think oftentimes when you ask people, you like true crime podcasts, but you don't want to serve on a jury, like, well, how do you reconcile that? People think like, oh, it's just, it takes too much time to serve on a jury, or the trial is going to be really boring, and it's not going to have the same dramatic pull that a good TV show or podcast has. But I also think that people are often afraid to have to judge, that it's a difficult decision, and I think especially for people on the left, they don't want to be in the position of having to reconcile like the deep racial injustices they see in the criminal justice system, and then maybe the particular case in front of them, which may point to a guilty verdict, or may suggest that punishment is the right outcome. And so I think especially for left-leaning people, there's been this fear about being tools of a system that they see as unjust, but I think that's giving up too much responsibility. I think that we need everybody to do the work of being jurors, and we also need to work for things like prison abolition and restorative justice possibilities and alternatives to incarceration. But I think taking on the responsibility of being a juror and saying, like, I want to sit with this and think about it. And if I don't want to send someone to prison, I need to think about why that is, and see how other people feel about this. So I think that, like, taking on that responsibility and then saying, like, I'm still, like, a good person to judge this is part of what's radical about serving on a jury, that creates a relationship to other citizens and also to the law that can carry over to public life more broadly.
And you talk about the fact that working on it, or sitting on a jury or serving on a jury and coming into that experience with to some degree a perspective perhaps shift from where most of us perhaps are now, and thinking about like our role as a juror, not only in the case, but also with regard to the law, is also a different component with regard to, say, the criminal justice reform efforts. And I'm curious about how the two things are connected, but also disconnected.
Could you say a little bit more about what you're asking?
The suggestion with regard to radical enfranchisement, which in terms of my understanding from the book, is about thinking about citizens having a better sense of what they're doing in the jury room with regard to not only the case that's in front of them, but as you talk about, also interpreting the law itself. And I was wondering how that is connected or not as connected to the broader projects that we're seeing around us with regard to criminal justice reform in terms of enfranchisement of former felons, reducing the number of people incarcerated, and so forth.
Yeah, no, thank you. So one of the more controversial suggestions in the book is that all citizens should be educated in the power that juries have to nullify. And what nullification means is that jurors in a particular case decide that they want to render a not guilty verdict, even though there might be overwhelming evidence, even though it might be obvious that the law was broken, but they choose to offer that not guilty verdict because they either feel that the defendant is worthy of a particular type of compassion, or they think that the law itself is unjust, or they think the prosecution was corrupt, and so therefore it's an illegitimate trial. But jurors always have the ability to offer a not guilty verdict and without being sort of second-guessed by the other officers of the court or having to explain their verdict, right? Right now, with jurors, we don't ask them, like, is your, logic sound? You know, do we agree with it? Jurors, have that final decision-making power and are able to offer a not guilty verdict. And that's a protected right of the jury. And in a way, it's the right that keeps the whole thing together, right? Because if there could be this kind of correction when a not guilty verdict is offered, it doesn't serve the purpose of checking the state and checking the power of the prosecution in any meaningful way. But currently, you are not allowed to kind of educate jurors about nullification outside of a courthouse. If you say that you know about nullification during the voir dire process, which is the selection process of jurors, a judge will most likely ask you to leave. You'll be excused from the jury pool because it's thought to be this very volatile power that could easily be abused. Because even though the power is there to be used in cases where the jury believes that a punishment would be inappropriate, someone could use it, and we actually saw this happen a lot in the South in lynching cases where jurors knew that that the white defendant had engaged in lynching but did not want to punish him for it, and those were nullifications. It was not a question of not having enough evidence or not understanding the law. The jury decided to acquit. The power to nullify is a very potent one and can be misused just like with anything else. But I argue that keeping it a secret from jurors has kind of distorted the way people understand what their role is, and also not allowed people to use it when it might be appropriate to use it. My opponents would say, but we do see juries using it when they are really moved to do so, and that's the right level of nullification. For example, kind of the change in marijuana laws in this country came about in part because juries were refusing to punish people who had a small amount of marijuana on them, or they didn't see it as a really threatening offense, and so juries kept offering not guilty verdicts in marijuana cases, and the prosecutors got the message. Then they stopped bringing those cases. And then if you're not going to bring the cases, then maybe we shouldn't have that law on the books. Changing the law through jury decisions is not the only way of changing it. And I'm not suggesting that it's That it replaces other types of legislative action. But it's an important form of information about which laws are working and who they're working for or against, and what people who are experiencing the law think about them. And if we kind of track who, when people are punished and when they're not, we get all of this information about the law. And so I think telling people about nullification is a way for them to understand that they really do have the power to stop a law from being enforced if they don't agree with it. And to your question about how does it connect to other reforms in the criminal legal system, I see it as really kind of a part of that. The chapter in my book on nullification is called, nullification in the age of abolition, right? So you can work for the end of prisons and still believe that you should be a juror and then nullify in certain cases. And the idea is that it's that in these criminal reform movements, as well as in my argument about enfranchisement, we're trying to get citizens to see that you can respect the rule of law, you can believe that the law is an important institution that plays an important role, yet still work to reform it, work to change it, go against what the officers of the court might want when you practice nullification, see your responsibility not just to kind of resist the law, but then also in other parts of your life to build up alternative institutions, alternative ways of dealing with disputes and violations that would remove power from the parts of the law that you think are coercive to another different type of method.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccoli, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And so this is what I found really interesting as well in terms of thinking about the idea of educating citizens about jury duty and the sort of role of the jury in our system is we don't necessarily have very much of that. It doesn't come through in civic education per se when you are in grammar school. And so you talk about things like the jury project and other aspects of where this could happen. Can you talk a little bit more about how and where this could happen in terms of educating citizens a bit more?
Yeah, no, I think it can happen more at every level. I think even starting in grammar school, I think it should not just be like knowing what the jury is and that it's constitutionally protected, but being involved in adjudication and in the school, right? Be thinking about what skills are necessary to be a juror. There is a suit going on in Rhode Island now where parents have sued the state for failing to provide a quality public education to students. And one of the things the parents are saying is that it's not preparing students for citizenship. It's not preparing them to be jurors. The schools are not teaching the skills of critical thinking, comprehension of navigating biases, of statistical understanding, of psychological perceptions, that are all of these things things are required to be jurors. And so I think there's a way to both think about it as a part of the curriculum of like, how can we teach students to be jurors? And then there's also more sort of straightforward forms of civic education of like, these are all the things that that you should know about being a juror. And part of that is also is not assuming that you just kind of walk into the courtroom and kind of your whatever you do there is appropriate for being a juror. I sometimes joke that I think jurors should also wear robes, because it's like, it's a good sign that like you're doing something different. It is, and you are especially like respected because of it. And so you bring in, your life experiences and so much of what you know about human nature into the courtroom, but you also have to pay attention to all of these other things. And you also have to question some of the assumptions and shortcuts that you make in the rest of your life when you are a juror. So I think teaching people through civic education, it's a role that we play, and thinking about the complexity of playing that role, right? It's impossible to be impartial in the way that jurors are often told, and sometimes it's even the delusion of this impartiality that causes the problem. For example, jurors in the trial of George Zimmerman for the killing of Trayvon Martin said, like, we never thought about race at all when we, came to our decision to acquit. And so that doesn't seem to be the right way to think about that case. So understanding how it is that we grapple with our biases, both conscious and unconscious ones, how we talk to other people in a way that we can truly listen to what they might be adding to the conversation. How do we, disagree and then decide how to move forward? So I think these are all skills that we can focus them when we're thinking about the jury, but clearly are very relevant outside the jury room. And then you brought up the Juror Project, which was this project started by William Snowden, a public defender in New Orleans. And his what he saw was that a lot of people in New Orleans didn't know much about what a jury duty entailed. They didn't really see it as that important, or they thought they didn't have the time for it. So he kind of developed this like 1 hour workshop that he would take to like community halls and schools, and I attended one at the Urban League, where he would do kind of a mock a jury selection process. He would talk about the history of discrimination within juries, and then the importance of having diverse juries. There's evidence that's shown that when there are jurors from different racial backgrounds, the deliberation goes on longer. People are more likely to ask questions. It seems like the process is more engaged when people from different backgrounds serve on a jury. And we just know that people of color are greatly underrepresented on juries. And so changing the way people think about jury service is one way to fix that. The other way to fix it is on the side of the selection. And I've written about how we need to get rid of peremptory challenges, which is the dismissal of jurors without cause, just because one side doesn't like a juror. They have a certain number of cards they can use to say, like, okay, we please remove 17. And then the other side can say, okay, yeah, we don't want number 5. And so 17 and 5 go. Even though there was no cause particularly for them to be eliminated. And what we've seen is that peremptory challenges are often used to remove people of color from the jury. So there needs to be a change both in how people think about wanting to serve on a jury, but also big changes in terms of jury selection.
And you just pointed out one of the sort of underlying points that you sort of weave throughout a lot of your analysis is that there are a variety of sort of biases that are sort of moved aside often in terms of who gets to be on a jury in the United States, and that there are racial dimensions to this, that there have been gender dimensions to this as well. Can you talk a little bit about how sort of that's both a problem and how your argument here with regard to radical enfranchisement, besides removing peremptory challenges, would also get at some of those problems?
Yeah, I mean, I think one just call, like reminding people that the other part of being a citizen is serving on a jury brings that question of who is serving, how we select them to the forefront again. One interesting thing is that the issue of the jury oftentimes unites people on the left and the right. That, you know, right now we have a very conservative Supreme Court, but in recent years they have ruled on certain cases that have strengthened the power of the jury. They ruled in a racial discrimination case, Flowers v. Mississippi, last year, where they, you know, thought that a white prosecutor's actions in this trial of a black defendant were, you know, inappropriate and racist, essentially, and they remanded the case. Right, they didn't respect the verdict. So even a conservative Supreme Court cares about the jury, and I think reframing or re-understanding how enfranchisement means that you are seen as sort of worthy of serving in this highest decision-making capacity is a good way to try to get some changes in how we select jurors. In addition to removing peremptory challenges, I also think we need a better way of drawing a random sample. Right now, people who call for jury duty, their names are often taken either from voter registration lists or DMV lists. So this method of selection disadvantages people who don't have a car, who might not have a permanent address, who move frequently, we'd be better off following the process used in Massachusetts, which is every year to have residency lists, and so at least it's an up-to-date list of people who live in a certain vicinity during that year. And we should draw a random sample from that. So once we have a more diverse sample, then we can focus on how are people, selected or removed from the pool. And what was exciting about that workshop I attended in New Orleans was at the end of it, people said, like, now I actually want to serve on a jury. Like, I'll tell people in my family to serve. Before, it was just really easy to dismiss it as an inconvenience. And now I know why it's important, and I think it might be interesting. And just having that shift in attitude changes the way you answer questions when you're asked during jury selection. When you want to be there, you don't need to lie or anything, but you just are open to the challenge and open to answering questions in a way that suggests that you are ready to do the work of being a juror. So I think a little bit more enthusiasm about serving, in addition to big changes in the selection process, would really change the way sort of juries look.
So we were talking about the understanding of sort of the more open disposition that jurors may have coming into being a juror, if they have a more positive understanding and sort of more agency in terms of being associated with that role as part of their citizenship. Would that be the case in terms of better understandings of what it is you are doing as a juror and the kind of power that you have, not only with regard to the case in front of you, but also in terms of the law?
I think so. And I think that, Yeah, that it just shows, like, the jury system shows such faith in you know, the American people, right? And when I presented this to people from other countries that don't have jury systems, and that's the vast majority of countries in the world right now do not have a jury system, they are always like, why would you ever do that? Why would you ever give power to, like, you know, any random person? And so I think the more people understand about why we have it, about, you know, I really see the jury as like a Trojan horse that kind of got, you know, snuck into the American system, which has otherwise been, you know, consolidating power in a smaller and smaller number of people. And, you know, right now, less than 5% of cases go to jury trial. So, while we have the power, in reality, and, you know, we're not taking, you know, much advantage of it. But I think we can change the way people think about the kind of remarkable institution that we have in the jury, and that they are actually the kind of person who is supposed to be on the jury, right? That it's not just about passing the buck and hoping someone else can do it, but that it's a satisfying, important, powerful aspect of citizenship.
And you also introduce early on in the book the discussion that Alexis de Tocqueville has with regard to the merits of this system in the United States is one of the points that he's particularly complimentary of with regard to the American system. But you also have a critique of his understanding of the jury system. Can you talk a little bit about how this Tocquevillian concept of the jury is one that we are still sort of wrestling with?
Yeah, when I first started doing this project, I found that, you know, almost any, project about the American jury, said, like, you know, Tocqueville understood it, you know, and Tocqueville is the kind of patron theorist of jury studies. And that's because, like, he was incredibly enthusiastic about the way that it, you know, fit with his understanding of the power of local participation in the American system. And that's where we develop civic norms. But he also really appreciated the jury because it took ordinary people, lay people, and allowed them to experience, you know, what he thought of as, like, the majesty of the law and the courts firsthand. Tocqueville thought that, you know, that judges in this country were kind of the closest thing we had to an aristocracy, and that when jurors were called in and were treated with respect by judges and could observe what judges did close up, they would also get a little bit of that disposition, and so they would want to learn from and even to mimic the judges and lawyers in the courtroom. And that itself was a form of education. You know, he famously called the jury, you know, a schoolhouse that is always open. Right? So he really saw the pedagogical function of the jury as very important. And I've also talked about why the jury has plays this important educational role. But where I diverge from Tocqueville is that I think he never lets jurors graduate from that schoolhouse. He, like, always wants them to be in this deferential relationship to the judge and to lawyers. And I think that sometimes that deference gets in the way of jurors realizing that they are supposed to represent a different perspective, and they are not supposed to just do the work of what lawyers or judges want them to do. That and as I said in the beginning, it's an asset that they don't know all this about lots of things about precedent, about technical aspects of the law. They're supposed to engage with the case under a certain number of guidelines, and they're not supposed to disregard things like the standard of proof or even rules like you can't be on social media during a trial. But they don't need to show deference in every single way to the judge. And when they come up with a nullification verdict, that's one place where that's not in deference to the judge. In my chapter on the hung jury, I also talk about how sometimes jurors change their vote because they feel like the judge wants them to, or because it will feel like an unsuccessful trial if it's a hung jury. So part of my critique is that I think there should be a little bit more of a sense of contestation between the judge and the jurors, and that this is a productive dynamic for the courtroom.
And I just wanted to ask you a little bit more about some of these concepts that you are discussing throughout the book, things like hung juries and what that actually means, and how that fits into the idea of radical enfranchisement, as well as these questions of reasonable doubt. I mean, these are always the terms that we hear with regard to jury deliberation and courtroom sort of instructions. Can you talk a little bit about sort of those concepts in this context?
Yeah, it's funny because it's like we all know these terms, and I think that in some ways we also know that like if you become a juror, you can be held in contempt of court if you do things that that you're not supposed to do. So there's this sense that like you are like, sort of learning these important concepts from the judge and then using them right there based on these vague understandings that you might have gotten from TV or from civic education. And I think that these concepts are really rich concepts and worth talking about more. And so part of why I think jurors need to be educated prior to the courtroom. One is because the courtroom does come with a certain deference to the judge that is like built into that space. And so if we learn about being a juror in other spaces, we might be able to see more of the fullness of the role. But also because a term like reasonable doubt like is worth talking about with other people and trying to figure out how you understand it and what are some of the different ways of thinking about it, or what are some of the dangers in taking shortcuts and trying to make a decision based on reasonable doubt. And so I think that because there are these kind of key terms that people sort of know, we oftentimes miss out on the opportunity to think about them more in the context outside of the courtroom. And then if we are called to be jurors, we have to apply them maybe don't feel as equipped to do it as we might if we had had more discussions of it before. But I think there's a lot of like misinformation about some of these terms, but sometimes it's not willful, or like it's not anybody's fault that there's this misinformation, because there's a lot of variation between states on different things, between the federal system and the state system. So I think kind of all the more reason why a more thorough education before you enter the courtroom is necessary, so that you can, so that you feel comfortable with some of these key terms, because they will shape the way that you act when you're in that space.
So my next question is one that I've been sort of trying to wrap my head around in terms of reading through the book and thinking about what does the radically enfranchised jury room look like?
Yes, that's a good question, and the final chapter in the book looks at a couple of different cases, and it thinks about what a radically enfranchised jury might have led to. So these were actual cases, and I kind of engage in some like post game analysis of them. For example, there's the case of Cecily McMillan, who was an Occupy Wall Street activist. Who was on trial for assaulting a police officer. This was a police officer who was trying to remove her from Zuccotti Park. As he was trying to get her out of the space, like she elbowed him and injured him, and she was on trial for that. And the jury in that case deliberated. They came up with a guilty verdict, but they sent a letter to the judge signed by 9 of the 12 jurors saying, while we came up with a guilty verdict, we really don't think punishment of any significant duration is appropriate in this case. Like we felt kind of tied to the letter of the law, but we don't think she should be imprisoned. While I understand the sentiment, and it was good that jurors were able to express it in this way, they miss the opportunity of their greatest power. And that was the moment of the decision. And I think if they had been radically enfranchised jurors in some sense, they would have known that, about the possibility of nullification, that they could have said, yes, Cicely McMillan, there's enough evidence to show that she should be guilty of this assault. But we don't think that a guilty verdict is appropriate in this case, and we will vote not guilty. The fact that only 9 of the 12 jurors signed this letter suggests that maybe they wouldn't have gotten a unanimous verdict, that those other 3 that actually thought like she was guilty and she should be punished might have made it such that they couldn't have reached a consensus. But I think a radically enfranchised jury knows about the range of possibilities that are open to them, and knows that where the jury has the power is in the decision, and it's not in the sentencing, and that this that would have shaped their verdict. I also bring up the case of the Central Park Five, where 5 black and brown teenagers were falsely accused of attacking and raping a jogger in Central Park. And that case hinged on the confessions, which were later found out to be false confessions of the teenagers. And even in the Central Park Five trials, the teenagers said, like, we were told what to say, we were told what to write in our confessions. The videotape shows that we were not doing it willingly. Voluntarily, but the jury had a really hard time understanding how people could confess to a crime that they didn't commit, and have all of these details that seemed to be connected to the crime. How could they have written that if they really didn't do it? And I think part of the education of jurors would also be about what we know about the psychology of defendants, and so the first time that they're in a jury room would not be the first time they'd be hearing about the prevalence of false confessions, and especially with youth defenders, how that might have come to be. Oftentimes issues like the veracity of false confessions are debated within a trial, where you have one side saying that this was a false confession, the other side saying presenting an expert that is going to dispute that. But I think that takes the issue and puts it into this adversarial framework, kind of saying like there's 2 different versions of this. Whereas when jurors are educated about these topics before they get to the courtroom, it's not being presented that way, and it doesn't feel like it's like lawyer tricks that are being used on both sides, but rather like they will have understood like what is the dynamic that leads people to falsely confess. And then in a specific case, they can draw on that, and they will get new experts, but they will have some knowledge that they're bringing into the courtroom to help them understand what they're hearing.
And so in a lot of your work, I see a thread with regard to this question of deliberation and ideas of citizenship. So my question to you is, what are you working on now?
I decided that I still have more things to say about the jury, and that this book in some ways like is like the opening gambit. Like I want to say anything more about the jury selection process. I'm working on a piece about the jury in the Angela Davis trial. So Angela Davis was on trial in 1971. For conspiracy and for kidnapping and tied to the murder of a judge. And she had an all-white jury in California for that trial. And everything I thought looked like it was set up for her to be convicted. She was seen as this radical communist, black philosophy professor. And the jury came back not guilty. So I'm writing about how we might understand that jury in the Angela Davis trial to be a jury of her peers, even though they didn't look anything like what her peers would be. So really investigating the standard of peerhood and what that means.
Well, will you come back on the New Books in Political Science podcast and talk about that book when it's done?
Yeah, I would love to. This was really fun.
All right. Thank you for joining me today, Sonali, author of Radical Enfranchisement in the Jury Room and Public Life, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2019. And I assume one can pick this book up at the University of Chicago Press website, as well as other places.
Yep.
Unless there's a brick and mortar store you want to give a shout out to in days of pandemics.
Yeah, no, I think the Chicago website is a great place for that.
Okay. Thanks for joining me today, Sonali.
Thanks, Lily.